The first couple of years, we were doing consulting, making enough money to live, just making things and having fun writing code and learning how to do it. For me, it was just the delight of making things work and growing. As a builder, every couple of months, I could look back and be like, I just did something in 4 hours that would have taken me a week 2 months ago. And finally, we like got a product that people actually wanted.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, you might also like my personal newsletter. It's not really news, but it's a letter from me to you. Each week, I share a lesson, a question, or an idea that I've picked up while learning from others. Subscribe at adaminseattle.com. On this episode, I met with Galen Ward. He's the former CEO and co-founder of Estately. They're a company that was able to do a lot with a little. With just over $1 million raised, Galen spent over a decade building Estately to a successful, profitable business and sold it a couple of years ago. He's now thinking about his next thing. In this conversation, we talked about some of Galen's lessons building the company profitable, how he thought about the acquisition, and how he's thinking about what to do next. I hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm here with the one, the only, Galen Ward. Hey, Galen. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Adam. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to talk to you fresh off your sabbatical, year off. What do you call this little transitional phase you've been in?
I didn't have a great name for it, so I did call it a sabbatical. I took, a little over a year off. Some of it very intentionally. I started last spring of 2019 and spent a bunch of time becoming the primary parent and caregiver at home and took care of my kids and picked them up from preschool and elementary school and traveled a bunch last summer. And then they were both in elementary school last fall. And I finally got bored and was thinking about what's next. And then COVID hit and I went back to being a full-time parent and began being a full-time homeschool teacher also. I'm back as of about a month ago, starting to find some itches to scratch.
Did you actually disconnect for that year and truly take a sabbatical, or was there some part of your brain that was pondering or processing what might be next?
I ended up talking to people, talking to startup founders. I ended up advising a couple of companies and helping, like just having a bunch of one-off conversations or two or three off conversations along the way. So I did stay active, but I got to say, taking care of kids can really make it hard to keep the other part of your brain going, the work part of your brain. They're really different parts. And kids can interrupt a lot. They can make it hard to have deep thoughts or hard to spend an hour focused.
Now that you're out of being the primary caregiver, are there any lessons from that you think are going to help you in your next step as an entrepreneur?
I think there's a lot of stuff from Estately and from parenting that works for parenting and vice versa, like that just in terms of personal growth. I think I got better at repeating myself as a CEO and reminding people why we're doing what we're doing and saying it over and over. And that's true as a parent. I probably speak more slowly and more clearly and try to get off on less tangents as a parent. That's something I've learned that one tangent can cost a half an hour of time when you're trying to get somewhere or trying to do something. And at the same time, no, parenting is really different. There's a lot of talk about kindness and respect, and you don't have to do that if you have hired good people at a company. And a lot of parenting is being there and not overthinking it and not trying to maximize every minute, which is really hard for me. That's probably the hardest thing about parenting for me, is I spend a lot of time being like, okay, let's do the next thing. Let's do the next thing. Just kind of like I do at work, but maybe it will be good for me not to do that quite as much at work in the future. And just to be like, you know what, we're going to spend 10 minutes talking about this, even though I don't think we need to, or we can settle in on this. I'm fine. I can not be quite so antsy and wanting to move. But I think there is a need for quickness and movement and decisions in a company that is not required as a parent of a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old.
So you had, before this year off, you had a journey building Estately that it was about a dozen years, wasn't it?
It was I don't have a good count actually anymore. I think it was about 10 years before we sold it. My co-founder and I started at the beginning having neither of us having worked at a tech company or having even written code for it. We wrote code for a little bit of PHP here and there as contractors. He had a CS background. I didn't. So we really had no business starting Stately. So yes, it was 10 years, but sometimes I like to, you got to discount the beginning of almost every company, and you got to really discount the beginning of Stately since we had no business starting a company. And we didn't really, like, I've met founders who have more business starting a company, and I'm like, you should go get a job. This is going to take you forever when I meet them today. Thankfully, neither of us were employable at a tech company at that time. So we couldn't get a job, and we had to just keep sticking with it until it worked. Probably my first 2 years was like, my thought process was, I want to be good enough at writing software that if this fails, I can get a job writing software. And I think I got there, and then we raised a tiny bit of money and we hired our first software developer. And then there were three of us and I stopped writing software. And within 6 months, I was like, all right, I have to get good at enough at being a manager so that I can get a job being a manager if this fails. And I think I did. I think I've accomplished that. But yeah, it was, yeah, the first couple of years we were doing consulting, making enough money to live, just making things and having fun writing code and learning how to do it. For me, it was just the delight of making things work and growing as a builder. Like I could, every couple of months, I could look back and be like, I just did something in 4 hours that would have taken me a week, 2 months ago. And finally, we like got a product that people actually wanted. We spent a lot of time like showing people stuff and they'd be like, that's like friends even. And friends would be like, yeah, I don't want that. And I'd be like, really? You're my friend. You're supposed to be supportive. Thankfully, my friends aren't super supportive or weren't at all times because I would have leaned into a bad idea. But yeah, then we finally got we finally started to figure out traction and figure out how to get customers. And I started making a little bit of money. And like I said, raised a small amount in an unconventional seed round and then raised a more legitimate real seed round from Bay Area folks and Seattle folks. And by that point, we really had like revenue. We were profitable, or we could pay the bills with five people. And that's really been a Stately's history, or a lot of our history was like raising money, growing on that money, and then being revenue neutral after that and growing on revenue. And we did that two or three times through our history.
At the time, being just new to the startup world and naive to a lot of the dynamics, did you realize how uncommon it was that companies had profit or were kind of running on their cash flow then? Or was that kind of a conscious business model choice to go against the venture model? Or is that something you fell into?
No, there were like probably 15 things, choices that I didn't think were choices at that time that I made, and choices that would be like very wrong for me to make now or that I would do very differently. But at that time, I could not imagine letting something fail. Running, like looking at a runway and being like 50-50 odds we would go right off the edge of that thing was not in my wheelhouse. Like I was not capable of doing that. I was like, we need to cut costs and we need to figure out how to make it so we get off the runway, we start lifting off. I want to feel really confident about that. And it's stressful. It was fun stress. It was not fun stress, but at that time I was not into the idea of raising a whole bunch of money without being really confident. And I think I was an optimist, but not like a crazy optimist. So I didn't round 25% odds up to 100. So I probably rounded 90% odds up to 100.
Do you think there was some benefit in thinking that way versus other mental models you could have brought to it, right? Like the focus on sustainability and not wanting to die. Versus, I guess I'm not categorizing this, but versus this high conviction, rah, rah, dream big. Is there anything from that that you'll pull forward next time around?
I think it was the right choice for the time. So for where we were as managers and visionaries and people who can run operations at a company, I think raising a lot of money would have killed us. And many of our real estate competitors died, and many of my cohort of naive, optimistic founders led companies that died without money or died with a lot of money. So there were probably better paths too, but it was not a horrible path that we took. Next time around, I think the learnings I would take for next time around are don't do big projects. That was one of our big things. So we had a culture of, you could say it's a culture of shipping, but it wasn't just software. It was everybody. It was like everything. What can we do by Friday to that's neutral or improvement? So our software developers would write code on the first day. Our client service team would pick up the phones on the first day and start answering calls, even if it was awkward. We had a small team. Even when we had six people, our site would, we would push out code four times a day. Like you just see it in the Slack channel. It'd be like somebody's deploying. And the model was like, is it neutral or positive? If it is, change, update it and make it incremental so we can see the progress and you can make sure that you're not like building a sandcastle that's going to collapse the moment you try to launch it or try to build on it.
Was that something you were intentionally building into the culture from day one, or how did you arrive at that principle?
No, I was probably the first sandcastle project was some code I wrote. I spent 4 months writing some code. It was a total disaster. It wasn't a disaster, except it was we threw it away about 2 months after and realized that we just needed a button that said, go see this house, which would have, I was like, oh, I can do that in an hour. But this 4 months of code is what's going to really change the business. It's going to be amazing. And that code I didn't need to write that. I could have done that with another button and some emails manually passed back and forth. No, it was probably learned the hard way a couple times. We probably had two or three big projects where an engineer said, this has to be 2 months, or somebody said, this has to take 2 months. And each one of them was less, like, was not as valuable as it should have been. They're almost all of them were not valuable at all. Like those, anything that took more than 2 weeks. And I'm not saying that we weren't ambitious and we didn't do a 3 month project. It was just, if we did a 3 month project, we deployed a part of it within the first 5 days, whether it was client service team or whether it was code or whether it was a new product feature. Like our iPhone app, we had a beta, we had an internal beta within a week. And we were working on design and code at the same time. And within 8 to 10 weeks, we had the first version of the app. And it was better than what we had right before. That was always the mantra. People would say, oh, I think it needs 3 weeks. And I was like, what can we do in 1 week that's better or neutral? And is this better or neutral? And that was one of the things I repeated, better or neutral. And I think that really sunk into the team. And I think everyone's really liked it too. It's really nice to work on something, deploy it, work on something, do it, and not be just building and hoping that you're doing the right thing.
So as you're going through the journey, can you talk a little bit about you and your co-founder, how you grew and evolved and ran the business together, since you both came into it, I guess, at the same level of non-experience? Is that right? You were both naive at that point?
We were both naive. We had different kinds of non-experience. I was probably the person who wanted to grow a big company, and he was the person who wanted to have fun. I don't know if have fun, but be satisfied writing code and helping customers and creating a good business. I think a lot of there was a lot of balance between us. I think I was definitely the creative person who needed some balance on focus. And I think as I've gotten older, I've become more of the focus person, but their early days, it was every week I would have a new idea, and both for the business and like new startup ideas outside of the business. And Doug, my co-founder, was hugely helpful and thoughtful. And I know I totally stressed him out every time I had a new idea, but he would remind me of what our plan was. Like, didn't we say last week we were going to just keep working on this? Yeah. Or say, I don't think that's good. I don't think that's important. And our creation process was probably 50 ideas from me, or 50 random ideas or product ideas or ways of growing the business. And then Doug would say no to all of them. And then I would have to spend a week thinking about arguments and what would convince Doug. And half of them would die in my own head. And then another 25 I would bring to him and pester him about more. And then probably 5 would actually survive the Doug editing process. And yeah, Doug, I don't think he enjoyed being an editor, but he was really good at it. And our team actually ended up growing that way too. We had a lot of our software team and our business team. We had creative people who were balanced by more pragmatic people. And we always thought about balancing the team when we were hiring or adding people to the team. We didn't want 3 super creative, spazzy people. But you don't want three librarians all sitting together and not really thinking about what they could do that's really like crazy or interesting to make things faster or better.
How does a good editor, as you called it, like Doug, look in practice and in action day to day so that they're being helpful, but not like totally squashing the creative person like you, who is just generating dozens of ideas every day?
There's something to be said for squashing. Doug wasn't overly negative. I think that was part of it. I've worked with people who are like, no, that's a bad idea. And Doug was more like, I don't know if that's a good idea. Like, I think this other idea is a great idea. We should keep working on the thing that we said we'd work on and that we said would be our focus. Doug's personality is calm and non-confrontational, which was really, really helpful as an editor to be, for me at least. I know a lot of editors are hugely confrontational and they yell at people in like the newsroom, but in our world, Doug was calm and non-confrontational. And yeah, a lot of our company evolved, our culture evolved because of him. Like, we had no meetings. I remember one time I was like, Doug, this is just driving me crazy. We need to have a weekly meeting to talk about this. And he was like, why don't we just write an email and then people can think about it. And if they want to comment on it, they can reply or we can put in a process to get, but I don't like, basically he was like, that would be a third weekly meeting, standing meeting on my calendar. And I'm just not willing to do that. And we had a very low meeting culture as a result of it and a very thoughtful email driven culture for making decisions.
Is that something you'll carry forward, that kind of writing stuff down, reducing meetings?
Yes. However, it's not my instinct. I've developed that internally somewhat, but having Doug drive it was really helpful. And I think going forward, I will assemble a team that brings some of that to the table. Like, I can't do that entirely by myself. That's something that the team, Doug and the team, really made happen. And it was really great.
Nice. So you had to actually change your style to work in that environment then, even as the founding CEO. It was like, okay, oh, yeah. I'll adjust to this culture.
Yeah, I definitely have learned to adjust to a quieter, more written culture, and also learn to not call a meeting while I'm mad about something, sleeping on it. And writing myself a note, I remember like thinking like, I should sleep on this. I'm so angry about some code, something that probably an error that happened more than once. Like, you know, we already made this mistake. We shouldn't make it again. And being like, I'm so angry. And tomorrow I'm going to sell myself short. So I need to write an email now. And I need to have this conversation now when I'm angry. And just, I've learned to write that email to myself and then edit it the next day because those meetings weren't productive.
So you actually would write the email to yourself and send it to yourself and then come back and edit it? You had a rule, wait till the next morning, or what was
that? I've developed that. And I think, yeah, my batting average went up dramatically on actually doing that. There were probably some times where I still would call somebody or talk to them face to face while still livid. But for the most part, yeah, I actually write the email, hit send. That way it's in my inbox. We all have our weird to-do lists. That's one of my to-do list ways, is sending myself an email and snoozing it or something. And then read it the next day and be like, yeah, okay. Now how do I actually solve the problem? That was me venting.
I love that one. Can you talk about the process of selling? So you built this company for 10 years. How did the acquisition come about and what did the process actually look like of making that decision?
So we raised nearly $1.5 million total over the lifetime of the company. And we had been growing, like around the time when we decided to sell, we'd been growing 30 to 60% a year. And it was on revenue. It was for the previous 3 or 4 years. And as we looked around, we had these massive, well-funded competitors like Zillow, that was a public company. Trulia, it was a public company that was ultimately consumed by Zillow, Redfin, and they had teams devoted to one aspect of their business that were bigger than our whole company. And we continued to grow. And also we realized in the following 5 to 10 years, we would need to pair up with somebody bigger and be strategic part of a bigger company in order to really differentiate ourselves and continue that growth. That was how I thought about it. Like, we, if we were part of a big company, we could use their resources and our awesome product and customer acquisition and monetization model to make something bigger. So a couple things happened. We had some of those conversations internally. One of our competitors was acquired in an all cash deal by a Japanese company that wasn't on my radar at all. Like, I was like, oh, there are people out there who woke up hungry to buy a company, and they didn't even know that we existed, or they didn't really evaluate us. So at that point, I realized if we're going to do this, if we're going to be acquired, or if we're going to go out and sell, everyone with enough money to acquire us needs to know who we are, know what we do, and know how we could fit into their business. So I made a list of those people, talked to a couple of bankers, and decided ultimately that if they lowballed me, or they told me that a price that they would sell the company for, and I was like, if we get that, I'm just going to keep running the company. This is crazy. That's not acceptable. So made a list of the companies that could acquire us, that had enough cash that it wouldn't decimate them to acquire us, and where it would be strategic, and made sure that everyone who ran those companies knew who we were. During that process, actually on one of the first calls with one company, they said, we should acquire you. I was like, whoa, like, we haven't even met in person. This is just a phone call. And it almost sent up red flags. Like, it's like committing too soon. You're like, it's like being on a first date and being like, we should get married. And you're like, whoa, I don't think you've thought this through all the way. You don't even know me. Anyways, that was helpful though, because we had some more conversations with other people, and that company became serious about it. And it really kicked off the conversation with everyone else. Everyone else knew who I was. And then I could suddenly go back to them and say, hey, somebody's expressed interest in buying us. And I wasn't planning on selling right now, but I was planning in the next 2 or 3 years, but somebody expressed interest in us. So if you're interested, we should talk. And that process worked really well. We had 3 or 4 serious offers. One of them was too low to consider, and a couple were serious and were high enough to consider. And we got all of our ducks in a row before we even started this process. We spent like $10,000 or $20,000 on our lawyer, like putting documents together and making sure everything was signed properly and tidying house. Thank goodness, because that took a long time. And then we moved ahead with Realogy, the best offer and frankly, like the most strategic acquirer for us.
So going back a little bit to, you made this list of people who could acquire you and where it would be strategic. When you were doing that, did you have intent? Okay, we'd like to sell the business, or you were just reading the tea leaves on where the market was going and saying, okay, if that time comes, I want to be known.
The intent was there to sell at some point in the following few years, because we could just, I've seen this play out before where everyone's growing in an industry and then suddenly the top two keep growing and everyone else, the air is suddenly sucked out of the room. And we didn't want to be left behind when the air was sucked out of the room there. We wanted to be partnered with somebody who could grow us strategically, or we could help them grow strategically. So it was with the intent of selling.
Okay, but you had this long runway, so it wasn't like, oh my God, we need to sell the we want to sell the company tomorrow. Let's go reach out to the people who could buy us. Forethought on this.
Thank goodness. Goodness, we were running at break even, or we were making a little bit of profit, enough to pad our bank account each year. So it was at our discretion. It really had these phone calls where I said, I just want to know who you are. I don't have anything to sell. I just want to know who you are and about your business. And I want you to know who I am and about my business. Maybe we could work together someday. Right now, I can't see a way, but I just want to be on your radar and potentially meet up with you at the next conference.
How many of those companies were there that you reached out just to, hey, I want to be on your radar?
when I made the list, I was like, oh, this is going to be just, this is going to be, I'm going to be so busy. There's so many of these companies. And I started going down the list and I was like, oh man, a lot of these companies don't have that much cash or that much access to cash, and they don't have liquid equity. So the list was probably 10 to 15 companies. I looked overseas a little bit. We talked to both companies in Japan that could buy us, for instance, one of them who had already bought our competitor. But the list was not as long as I had hoped it would be when I sat down to make it.
Yeah, and I suspect that's true with a lot of people. And the world isn't huge when you start looking at all those criteria, right?
So there were some weird ones. As you start to think out, there were at that time, and now there are companies that want to get into adjacent spaces. So it wasn't just real estate companies. You could think of all the adjacent businesses. Title companies are multi-billion dollar companies. Mortgage companies make a lot of money. All of them ultimately want to know about transactions and participate.
What was the emotional side of this decision? Like when it came to actually having an offer, was it just a logical next step based on your analysis of the market? And you have such a practical and rational approach to this. Or when you and Doug actually had to make that decision, was there another debate or soul searching that had to happen at that point?
I know a lot of people who are like, oh, it was so hard. But for us, it was, I think, a bit of a relief. I think we were tired, especially of the roller coaster or of knowing that next year things could go south or go sideways. And so the emotions were probably relief and then the new stress of just like, now we have this offer and I have to somehow both work on the offer and keep all imagination or all keep that money out of my bank account in my head. I cannot visualize being like both having the money, but more importantly, not having the responsibility for this company until the day it closes. I just can't, like, it is just toxic to have your expectations to set them all the way up and then have them collapse at the end. So I tried to play as many mental games as I could to keep.
How well were you able to do that?
That's a good question. I think I did a decent job at doing that. Basically, I had run a company that was good and was never a rocket ship for long enough that I knew to keep my expectations reasonable. I'm not a golden child where everything just is perfect. So I didn't expect that this would go perfectly. I had enough advisors and, well, casual advisors helping me with the process that I knew it could go sideways, and in some ways it felt like it should have. It took a long time. It was a very long close, and every day that goes by, the conventional wisdom is every day that goes by is the increase the likelihood that something goes south. And it really felt that way. Like they could just wake up and decide maybe we don't want to buy this company, or we could wake up and be like, oh my God, we broke something, or we screwed up our business somehow, and now we have to go and tell them. And thankfully, that didn't happen during the process.
And you had to keep running the business, right? Because you're living off your cash flows. So you can't just check out of running the company.
Yeah. Thankfully, I had a team that was really good at running the business. So I could go out and do this without the business falling apart.
So as you start to look at your next thing, I'm super interested to hear about what's your process for figuring out your next venture, your next company.
My process is a little all over the map, frankly. I know some people who are top down who look at certain industries and they say, I'm going to figure out this industry, or some people are bottoms up and they have random ideas. And I guess I'm more bottoms up, but I'm a lot of my process, as I think about this, is not written down or formalized. I find myself talking to various founders about their businesses, about new startups, and often I end up with a cross-pollination idea where I hear about one startup idea and then I hear about another startup idea and I don't think of something right in the middle, but I end up with an idea that combines elements of the two. That's generally how my best ideas come from. I find myself drawn to semi-technical, product-driven companies. I don't want to sell clothes or really anything to people directly online. D2C is just, I've tried to be interested in it and I'm not. It's just, it's great that some people are. I just can't find it. It's just not. I find that I have to listen to my brain instead of trying to fall in love with an idea. I just have to start falling in love with it. For me, it's like the finding a product that's interesting and then a personal sense of fun. Hoping to work with a smart team, collaborative people that really, where I can really learn a lot and grow. That's what's fun about growing a company to me, is working with really smart people and essentially almost like playing a board game, like a really stressful competitive board game.
With people you like.
That's the idea. On your team, not against you. Yeah, you don't have to like the other people at the game.
Right. As you start looking at ideas, I'm curious, how do you suspend judgment or suspend disbelief now being a little bit older? Not super old, but you have some experience now. So versus just being able to naively jump into it like you did at the beginning of Estately, how do you retain some of that as you're exploring new things?
It is harder. At the beginning of Estately, we had no business starting a company and it wasn't necessarily the best idea. And I just didn't know that. And I talked to investors and startup founders who told me that. And I was like, whatever, you don't know what you're talking about. And I'm now that person. I have that voice in my head of this is a competitive market. This isn't a great idea. And I know that usually I'm right and sometimes I'm wrong. From talking to other founders too, I've become a lot more humble about judging companies and startup ideas. Like ones that I love don't always work, and ones that I think are really horrible ideas do work sometimes, and there are different ways of doing them. I'm a real product focused entrepreneur, but I know I've seen people who are just amazing sales entrepreneurs do it in a way that just baffles me. So when I think about it, I have tried to stick to an idea and ride the roller coaster of that idea. So I fall in love with an idea. That still happens, even though I'm old. But I quickly fall out of love with an idea as I do research and figure out the competitive landscape. And then I try within a week to just say, this is a job and I'm going to spend 2 months digging on this idea. I say that, and right now I have 3 ideas and I'm not digging on any. I'm digging on one of them hard, and then I have 2 other ideas that are like distracting me. But that's the plan, and that's what seems to work, is find an idea, dig on it, talk to people, talk to customers, potential customers about it. Not about the idea, understand what their world is like and make sure that my vision of their world is close to what their world is actually like. And then see if my idea would actually fit into that world.
So after so you have this initial, let me say it back and make sure I get it. You have this initial, you fall in love, and then you come down off that high and see if it lasts a week. And if it lasts a week, then you're, okay, would I spend 2 months really digging into the market, the customer, all the things that would make this work or not?
Yeah, usually most ideas within 2 days, I'm like, oh, it was actually just a bad idea. And I know why, and I can say why. And I don't have enough interest in it or love for it to spend 2 months systematically driving a stake into it. But other times it's just more doubt, and it's more neutral. It's, yeah, it sounds hard, and I don't really know if there's something there, but there might be something there. And those ideas, I feel like if I stick with them, they can evolve into something. They can either evolve into something that's good, or I can develop conviction after talking to people about them. And I'm really early in this right now. We'll see if this continues to be my process. I should probably read about other people's processes or listen to other people's processes for finding their second startup idea.
And in your mind, what is an idea? I know you're more bottom up, more product focused, but could an idea be like, oh, I just want to go attack this category, or I think there's a trend here? Or do you actually, an idea for you is like a specific problem, solution, customer kind of shaped out?
But it's funny. My process is pretty similar. Was at Estately for individual product ideas early on when I was doing all the most of the product development as it is for ideas. So I come up with an idea. It's usually like an actual solution or a solution. Yes. If you're on the big company website, it's the solution tab. And then I back out to what is the problem this is actually solving? And is there actually a problem there? Because I like building stuff. So that's my first instinct is I should build this, even though I'm not a good software developer anymore. Sorry, never was a good software developer, but now I'm not even a mediocre software developer. But so I start small, like I start with this solution and then I back out to, is this actually a problem? And if this is actually a problem, and then once I've identified, is this actually a problem? Yes. Okay. Now I had one solution, but there are probably like five other solutions and one of those is going to be better to this problem. And that, I guess that's how I come up with product ideas.
I love it. Thanks for sharing that. I'm really looking forward to seeing what comes out of this and what you do next.
Me too.
I want to wrap up now. Yeah, you'll find out it's a mystery to both of us at this point.
Yeah.
I want to wrap it up with the Supersonic Six. Number one, how much coffee do you drink?
2 cups, typically in the morning.
Number two, what's one Seattle company that you're following or studying right now?
Recurrent is a company that looks at used electric car batteries, and also happens to have Estately's CTO as its co-founder.
Number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
Liz Pierce, because she just has such a great presence and a great ability to, or capacity to clearly describe things and lead people, as my experience.
Liz was on this podcast a few months ago. She's amazing.
Yeah.
Number four, what's the one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
I think Seattle needs to embrace the right kind of weird culture. Embrace the right kind of weird. We have a lot of B2B companies that are pretty vanilla and boring. And then we have these companies that are way out there and just flail. But there's this sort of sweet spot of weird and fun and creative companies that I want to know about and want to participate in, at least just to watch them. And I think that's like a culture and capital issue where we need creative people to be embraced and then capital to follow.
Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
Probably that I should take some CS classes. That would be the only advice I would have listened to. That would be good advice. There's lots of good advice that I would have been like, okay, whatever. But take some CS classes, maybe even like major in it or math.
Number six, what can this community do to help you? Do you have any call to action, anything you want people to look at or reach out to you about?
I don't have anything to look at to show right now. And I probably won't for quite a while, but I love talking to founders, hearing about them, helping them with fundraising or product problems or customer acquisition. So that those connections always, I feel like I get as much out of it as founders do. So if a founder wants to talk.
What's the best channel to reach you on?
You can always talk to me on Twitter.
Twitter it is. And your
Galen
handle?
Ward. My handle is Galen Ward. There aren't a lot of Galen Wards in this world.
Perfect. Hey, Galen, thanks for coming on the podcast. I really enjoyed this.
Hey, thank you.
Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.